Hello, and welcome to The Rest is Education. I'm David Marshall, co-host of the podcast, and I'm delighted to be here with James Page, Chief Executive at Haringey Educational Partnership, who's been working on Opening Worlds curriculum, which we'll hear more about a bit later, with Christine Council. And also here with Cindy Gass-Vega, educational consultant and former head teacher in the Czech Republic. She's been focused on professional learning and has a long lifetime experience in collaborative inquiry-based learning. This episode is part one of two looking at the value of curriculum education with a focus this week on the primary sector. So we'll be asking what makes an excellent primary curriculum. Welcome, James. Welcome, Cindy. Hi.
Hello. Hi.
Thanks for having us.
I was thinking about the idea of a curriculum, and in the UK where I'm based, our curriculum came into force in 1989 with the Education Reform Act. So that was the national curriculum for England, Wales and Northern Ireland. And rather, it was established in 1988 and came into force in 1989. So the first few years of my education were not directed by a curriculum across the country. And so it wasn't for me until the start of Key Stage 2 in Year 3 that it would have affected me at all. And the extent to which that did or didn't provide me with a sound foundation for education is really up for debate in those early years anyway. What isn't in question today, I think, is the value of curriculum design to excellent education and the importance that a well-thought-through curriculum makes to pupils everywhere. Before we start out, I would just like to ask a question, which is, what do we mean when we talk about curriculum?
You know, I've been thinking about the question since we spoke briefly in preparing for our conversation this afternoon, and I realized that the way I would define it is not actually what I think should be in place. So I'm going to say what I think we mean when we talk about curriculum, and I think it's quite similar to what the national curriculum does. It's they're documents or a roadmap that delineate intended outcomes for students, a framework, a system of assessment, standards, benchmarks, learning targets. It's a detailed roadmap, I think, for teachers to follow and for parents to be assured their children will be learning what they need to know. And I think that it's too static, perhaps, in what I think we need for a curriculum that guides learning. But that's part of the conversation today.
So that establishing the idea of what a curriculum might appear to be, which is a system of assessment, a detailed roadmap, but also maybe opening that question up to the idea that it's got to be flexible in some way. James, what do we mean by when we say curriculum?
Well, it's a very simple question, a very difficult question, I think, on two sides of the same coin. So fundamentally, curriculum is the stuff of school and education. It's the what that we want our children to learn. I sort of feel that on the one hand, what all of that adds up to can feel like a deep philosophical and moral endeavor. And yet on the other hand, on a more prosaic day-to-day level, it can feel like just the stuff that we just rush our children through. But fundamentally, I think what I'm trying to talk about is introducing children to bodies of knowledge and helping them to develop increasing levels of mastery within them, and then situating that in relation to how children understand the world. So that's obviously kind of the basics. And then the curriculum is enacted, I suppose, in the classroom and beyond, and through the craft and skill of not just one teacher, but every teacher on the student's journey through school. So I think, you know, it's being able to map and identify the things, the bodies of knowledge, and how we want our children to pass through those. But then the reality and the experience of the curriculum is what gets brought to life in the classroom and beyond.
Brilliant. That sort of, we've got alignment there, and also we've got points of tension, I think, that are going to take us forward, which is what's going to make this discussion really interesting. Cindy and James, you both mentioned the idea of a map, and then also that it's not enough. Or I think there's an implication there that it's not just a map. The mention of bodies of knowledge and also this idea of a journey. So maybe the next question is a bit hard to answer now in relation to that, but what are the key aims of a curriculum in a primary setting? What are the purpose of it? What's the purpose of a curriculum? What would we say?
I mean, maybe you mentioned kind of some of the tensions that might kind of drive things forward. And I don't want things to be tensions at all, because I think, you know, there's not one way to, you know, one right answer to everything in all times and all places at all. But I think there might be two schools of thought, you know, kind of broadly and very simplistically, I suppose. The first one maybe starts with the end point of what do I want my students to be able to do? And it might be more kind of focused on skills and values like thinking critically or being creative or collaborative or all of those sorts of things. And there's a second school of thought that starts with what we want our children to know, with the aim that that will empower children to be able to think critically, be creative, etc. And I think, you know, for the perfectly legitimate, you know, views in that first camp, it can be that the content maybe of it, and I talked about bodies of knowledge, that the content maybe can be slightly less important than it is to that second school of thought, and really kind of goes more directly for the skills, the qualities and the values that we want to inculcate in our children. And for the second group, I think, you know, it's a bit more the opposite, and that the content, the knowledge which enables children ultimately to be capable of how their skills, their values, their character develop.
Yeah, I think the challenge that we face now when we think about the aims for curriculum in a primary setting, it, and not only now, but always, is which knowledge, whose knowledge, which canon. And maybe that's particularly important in the world that I work in, because I've worked in international schools most of my professional life. It might be different if you're working in a national system. But I do think that the primary aim of curriculum in a primary setting is to nurture the natural curiosity and wonder and a passion for learning, and that that affords a context within which to develop the basic skills in reading and writing and maths and understanding of different subject areas while developing the learning habits and skills they need to continue to learn. And that includes what James mentioned, the critical thinking skills and the interpersonal skills. I think with access to knowledge and the overwhelming wealth of knowledge now, they have to know how to access that. And it's no longer our primary role to teach them what they need to know in terms of content. Because they can, if they know how to find the answers to their questions, and if we help them to learn to think like scientists and geographers and historians and writers, then they'll be able to continue to learn. And time is limited.
I think time always feels limited in the classroom. And as speaking as someone who is in the classroom every day, I do think a lot about this question, surprisingly, given that I'm just going day to day with teaching, and I'm just teaching English, but I am teaching in a primary setting. Because when we talk about aims in a secondary setting, it's relatively easy to say that they need to get through their qualifications and they need to be able to get this qualification so they can get jobs and or go on to higher education. When we're in a primary setting, we don't have that sort of pressure, but we do have the sense of those qualifications coming up. Any conversation about aims does have to take into account the need for preparing children for whatever they're going to meet in secondary school. James, when you're talking about this and when you're working with and collaborating with people designing curriculums, what emphasis do you place on things like, in the UK we do GCSEs, many schools do A-levels, but we have other qualifications as well. Do you talk about this when you're talking about primary curriculum? Is this a key aspect of your conversations? Do we need to get them through these exams, or do we need to prepare them so that they know this much stuff so they can get on and the secondary school can do this with them?
So I think that's a really good question. And there's maybe a kind of happy place that we can come to. I mean, I'm in education because I think it profoundly matters, and helping, you know, children to have the best access to powerful knowledge, to be able to understand themselves, the world and everything else. So I'm definitely not in it for the kind of instrumentalist, you know, let's just do whatever gets the best GCSE results, or indeed at primary, the best SATs results. But at the same time, I think there may be a happy overlap. I think there's been, particularly at secondary within subjects, but at primary, you know, a real kind of narrowing of reading, writing, maths, because that's what's assessed in the SATs and schools are judged on. And for many, many years, there's been a bit of an unresolved debate, I think, between the, do you narrow down and just really hammer reading, writing, maths to make sure the kids can pass the tests and do really well. And, being generous with a kind of, well, that's helping the children because they've got the fundamentals in place, which they can then take to secondary. But I think what the Ofsted framework has changed from 2019 has been quite decisive, actually. That's certainly the way it's felt to me, that actually providing a real understanding of the foundation subjects as well as the core, and doing so in a way that takes them very seriously in and of themselves. But then also, we recognize that, really well-taught history, really well-taught geography, really well-taught science actually contributes to children's ability to read, to write. Because when we talk about a reading test in the SATs, it's not whether children can read. The children can read, by and large. It's not very, very few who can't. It's the degree of comprehension, which usually comes from subject knowledge, because reading isn't a subject. It's not doing English literature. It's a reading test, which is not actually about reading. So as Daniel Willingham says, yeah, knowledge test in disguise. But that knowledge pops out of all of those other domains taken very seriously with that knowledge in children's heads. So if you've learned really key words like complex abstract nouns like institution in history, when it pops up in a text, you're not fazed by it and you understand it, but it's come from within that initial discipline.
David, can I respond to what James is saying, or do you have another question? No. I actually think that we're pretty closely aligned in how we're thinking. It may be different contexts in which we've developed the ways to talk about it. I think that in the primary school, children, there are some things that they have to learn directly in reading and writing and math, some basic skills. But basically, those skills are in service to developing understanding of big ideas or concepts and content. And so when we're working with curriculum development in the settings that I've been involved with, we're looking at what is interesting in world problems right now, and how do you understand the biology or the human geography in a setting. And so they're learning important content and using and developing those skills that James, you just mentioned. What I'm not sure about when I listen to you is, what do you mean by powerful knowledge?
Yeah, it's the concept that Michael Young kind of comes up with, but without wanting to kind of expound all that he said on it, there has to be, I think, going back to something that you said earlier, Cindy, whose knowledge, you said, I think, who's the one who's going to design what's in and what's out of the curriculum? You can't fit everything in; it's impossible. And so, I think there is a real question there, and that's why we've worked with Christine Council and Steve Mastin on the humanities in the primaries, for example, and with Brenda Hales on science curriculum, to really get deep expertise, scholarly expertise, but with a real understanding not only of broadly kind of across the history that fits with the national curriculum, but a deep understanding of the importance of diversity within all of them, and that good history, good geography is diverse history and diverse geography. We want a system of both mirrors and windows in the curriculum for our children, wherever we are. Maybe we kind of come back to that to some extent. But I think it is really important to find expertise that schools can then rely on and bring to life. There is no way that every primary in the country has A, the subject knowledge, B, the time and the capacity to be able to write expert curricula across different subjects. It just isn't possible. So for me, finding, the absolute best out there, and talking weekly as I do with Christine and Steve on the decisions in Opening Worlds and Brenda on science, I know how much depth of thought goes into this, and it's absolutely brilliant. And we tested all kinds of objections. This will be fine for the middle class kids. What about the kids who are growing up, much more disadvantaged? Will this be, much more a kind of white middle class curriculum? All of those things which have proven to be, absolutely not the case, but have to be debated out. They have to be.
Can I jump in there and say, proven not to be the case? Do you mean that these are things that you've looked at in designing the curriculum, but found to be not as prevalent or important as you thought?
Yeah, so number one, on the kind of diversity and representation side, that is absolutely built in. It's built in, not tacked on. You know, it's not kind of here's a unit here to cover this and tick a box. It's absolutely, you know, fundamental and core to the way the curriculum is designed. You know, so for example, thinking about Christianity in the Aksumite Empire, you know, after the fall of Rome, you know, not just how Christianity, you know, developed within the Roman Empire and beyond, and how all of that spread, you know, in Africa and not through missionaries later on. It's just one example, and there are many, 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 including getting the voices of indigenous Amazonians, you know, in geography and all of those pieces. So we've really kind of thought about that piece, but also just as fundamental is that actually the engagement with the curriculum and the outcomes for children who often don't get this level of support and, you know, intellectual discussion at home, being able to have a really tightly, carefully structured, knowledge-rich, exciting curriculum for them is just transformational. And they've said so themselves, unprompted, you know, examples of primary students in Edmonton literally said, "This changed my life." You know, it's absolutely incredible to listen to.
So I'm wondering again, listening to you, when I'm talking about curriculum, because I agree with everything that you're saying. I see that as central as well to curriculum in a primary setting. I don't have a picture yet of the pedagogies that are part of your curriculum. It's the enacted curriculum. So can you help me understand how that curriculum is being implemented?
Yeah, I can try. So fundamentally, the trick that this curriculum pulls off that I have never seen before is being able to be incredibly ambitious, but also incredibly inclusive. So systematically building children's understanding across the humanities in particular, and their vocabulary in what are essentially cumulative subjects, you know, so children encounter more and more examples, you know, whether it's of rulers or empires or whatever else it might be, as they move through the different contexts that they're working in and build up their vocabulary systematically. But fundamentally, it's not about teachers being robots and just delivering content in a kind of monotone, learn this fact, learn that fact. You know, that's not knowledge rich, that's information rich. And I think, you know, it's really about that making meaning, you know, based on a secure understanding and doing so with, you know, some teacher explanation, but also a huge amount of oracy in the classroom and making sure that every child is practicing, you know, the new vocabulary, the things that they've just learned in full sentences and differently, and that they have a chance to write about what they've learned. And only once the knowledge is secure, then reading really beautifully written and complex text together that really kind of brings to life the history, the geography, the religion that they've been learning. So it's pulling all of those kind of pieces together, I guess.
So I've got so many questions. I feel like one of the reasons that I run this podcast together with my co-presenters is because I'm in a classroom and I have all these things that I think about a lot. And you're basically here helping me to understand how I can best be a teacher in the modern world. So if I could just break down some of that, I think it does come into our next question, which is about the depth and breadth in terms of designing a curriculum. Because just to give an example of what I find is we've talked already about time being a limited resource. I want to teach children a book that I think is really worth studying, and we're going to spend most of the term or a bit of the term on it in key stage two. But mainly I'm teaching kind of fives and sixes. It takes a long time to teach a text, you know, particularly if you're going to go for something quite challenging, which I quite like to go for. My question is really about when I'm teaching this text, if I'm spending the whole term on one text, I'm not teaching several texts, right? So I'm losing out on teaching multiple different types of genres and different authors, and then the possibility for diversity is dropping quite significantly because if I'm only teaching about three to five texts a year, I've got to make decisions about who I'm going to represent. And it's coming back to that question, Cindy, you mentioned earlier about whose knowledge and breadth would be I can represent many different sort of cultures and I could represent many different viewpoints on the world, which is really important. But here's the thing, if I teach one text, I can get so much from that text. I can use it for writing, I can use it for grammar, I can link it to history, and also the children's knowledge of that text will mean they'll have read a whole thing and they can approach something else with the knowledge and the depth they have. That means they can independently pick up another equally challenging text, and they can apply all of that knowledge to it independently themselves, which I think is ultimately, Cindy, going back to your point about making them passionate and also that sense of independence, I think I picked up from your comment. So long introduction, I'm really apologetic for that, but how do we balance depth and breadth in a curriculum? I still don't know whether I'm fully doing it right, but do you have guidance for me?
I mean, you're describing what you, the choice you've made with your students and how you choose key texts that you think allow them to learn how to think about text and incorporate all the skills. 100% what you're describing is what I would advocate as well. It aligns with what I do with teachers and what we've tried to do over the years. And we often have chosen texts that enrich an understanding of a particular historical period or help kids make connections across subject areas. I don't know how that aligns with what James and his colleagues are developing.
James, what would you tell me? Would you say that I need to change it up a bit? Or
no, I mean, I think there's no one right answer to this, right?
That's okay, okay, that's good.
You know, there just can't be one right answer that is, you know, this is what you should do. So so I definitely, you know, defer to your, you know, your knowledge and expertise around, you know, the literature that you think, you know, the children will particularly benefit from. I guess there's really kind of, you're thinking in one subject and you're thinking key stage two. I'm just thinking, you know, if you're thinking by year six, what do I want the children to leave my primary school with? And then working back with colleagues, you know, through the whole, you know, kind of subject domain all the way back to reception and maybe even be before that. And just thinking about, you know, it's not kind of, well, in this year, if I, you know, do one text in more depth, then I've squeezed out more time for other things. It's looking at the entire, you know, how does the narrative of the curriculum, if you like, unfold, you know, across the subject, and where can I make links that can be really useful? So, you know, as you say, taking things, you know, that you can use in, you know, for writing skills. But equally, you can do that from history or geography or science, or, you know, when you've got really kind of embedded, you know, really well embedded knowledge from those that you can draw on, you know, for different writing exercises and things like that. But it's a challenge. And also the other thing that makes it a challenge as well, particularly when we're talking about reading, you know, is the particular nature of the SATs test. You know, it's not just what literature would we love our children to have experienced, and for that, and for those texts to have done their work on the children, as well as, you know, developing, inculcating the skills in the children to be able to address the text. It works both ways, I think, you know, in literature, maybe betraying that I'm an English grad. So I think, you know, on all of those fronts, how does it work as a whole? How does it work as a narrative across the entire time in that kind of transitional and temporary conclusion that year six brings?
Yeah, I like that those words, transitional and temporary conclusion, because that really is it. It's not a conclusion at all, but it is very much a transition. Well, I guess this does lead us on to the question, which includes something that's been mentioned already, which is diversity. And also, I think, James, you touched on this when you talked about the way you think about different settings. How do we design a curriculum for different settings, taking into account competing needs, subjects, time availability, staffing, equality, diversity and inclusion, such an important thing that we've talked about a little bit. We are working with multiple different settings. Your experience, Cindy, across three different countries and many different schools, I'm sure. James, you're working with one place in Haringey, but I'm sure there are many different types of schools that are signed up to Haringey Educational Partnership. How do we manage that?
Actually, something you just said, James, I'm going to go at this in a roundabout way about the literature we want our children to experience. And then I was thinking, well, what is the purpose of curriculum? Is the purpose to map out what we want children to experience? Is that what, based on our own experience and our own beliefs? Or are we starting from who they are as learners, which I think is embedded in this question, about the different contexts, different needs, or are we trying to wed those and balance them? That's where I'm a bit stuck in my own thinking. What's the purpose?
Yeah, and I don't think there's an easy way just to, just to kind of nail that down. I think
No.
David, your question as well is broad and I think impossible to answer in one go. I mean, as we've touched on, there's a large degree of choice in curriculum content. There has to be, there just is, despite there being a national curriculum. If you look at certain subjects, there's three bullet points. That's not going to take you from, reception all the way through to year six. So it's putting meat on the bones, of what's there. And like I said, about creating a combination of mirrors and windows so that our children feel seen in the curriculum, but also exposed to perspectives and knowledge that they wouldn't otherwise come across. And that's, I think, a good starting point, but it's only a starting point. And then to be slightly controversial and do that knowingly, I think there's a bit of a danger in the kind of, well, we know our children best, so we've designed a completely bespoke curriculum for them. Okay, but first there is the Common Core of the national curriculum, and everyone needs to learn about ancient Egypt, and that doesn't change whether, you're in North London or Newcastle. The ancient Egyptians are the ancient Egyptians. And secondly, the quality and the rigor of the curriculum is so dependent on the depth and up-to-date subject knowledge, which is not equally distributed across each primary. So you do want to kind of look at expertise, and curriculum designers who you trust, I guess. You're still going to have to make sure that it is right in that way. But I think, making sure that, good history, as I say, good geography, good art, good religion, literature, they are diverse. There's no question about that. But then around the subject time availability, staffing, all of those are huge challenges. And I think with the staffing, you might have an absolute expert geographer in a primary school, but it's quite rare. So it is, where do you get that expertise from? And where do you get that ongoing training, that professionalism, that subject knowledge, all of those things? And one of the things that we've definitely wrestled with in terms of the opening worlds, the humanities, is schools are meant to spend, if they're following the program with fidelity, 75 minutes a week on each of history, geography, and religion. Now, there's no way that fits into most primary timetables as they stand now. And so schools have had to make some pretty bold decisions. We talked about kind of hammering kind of literacy and writing and maths and all of those pieces. And actually, it had to think, actually, the benefits, take a leap of faith, the benefits that I'm getting from the wider foundation subjects for literacy are worth cutting back on the amount of time. And actually, the enthusiasm of the children for what they're learning has gone up massively as well. So hopefully that's positive.
So as I'm listening to you, I'm wondering, is the work that you're doing connected in any way to E.D. Hirsch's cultural literacy?
Not directly, but I would say there's an indirect line of knowledge being important rather than the skills hierarchy, and in no way a kind of prescribed kind of, and I know he regretted having ever put out a prescribed set of kind of concepts. But in terms of, does knowledge matter and that similar kind of philosophy, yes, I would say there is an indirect link there.
Children do love learning facts. I don't meet many children who don't love learning, who doesn't love learning knowledge, whatever way they come across it. I was thinking of my nephew actually, who's turned six this week. And James, I was thinking about what you said about the national curriculum. And I thought to myself, well, I think he loves history. I'm going to look on the Key Stage 1 national curriculum and find out what they're doing. So I looked on it. And I really couldn't work out what he's doing in history. I even tried looking at his school and seeing if they had anything about what curriculum they were doing. Because I thought, look, if I can find out if he's doing Romans right now, I bet he'll be really into Romans. He's six, you know. There's very, like you said, it's just pretty blank. There's no real detail. The only thing that I could work out, which is seemed to be, and this links to a podcast we did earlier in the year about history, there does seem to be a focus on local history as being a foundation or a touchstone for learning. And if you take a child to something like a local Tudor hall or something, and then they find out about their history through what's around them, and then through that, they can start to explore other things as well. That seemed to be a part of it, which I thought really, Cindy, for me, did link into what we were talking about with inquiry-based learning, because if you're taking a child to a sort of setting where they can visibly see and experience history, and I'm sure there's loads of different ways of doing that, That is going to be sparking inquiry. And often it's what you remember of school in primary school trips. I think the school trips stand out for me as being really memorable. I'm not saying there's not a lot of learning of knowledge there, but those things, they were points around which knowledge formed. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm thinking of a couple of examples. So two examples, actually, using the local context to learn about history and geography and social problems. So one of them is a unit of inquiry that has been taught at the school where I was for many years as head teacher about Prague. And they always start with taking, this is third graders, so year four in the UK system. They take the children into the center of Prague and they take photos of all the historical monuments and all of the statues and the buildings. And they learn to really see the history that's present all around them, and they learn Czech myths and legends, and the kids love the content. It's real to them. They're reading, they're writing about it, they're painting, and it's such a rich experience that I think it shapes the way that they look at any place that they are and how to explore it in greater depth. And it's also developing a powerful knowledge of where they are. That's one example. The other is, I just had a conversation with some teachers last week in Brno, a city in the Czech Republic, and they're going to inquire into the experience of the Jews in the Czech Republic with 8 and 9 year olds. And I was a bit hesitant because the history of the Holocaust and Jews in Europe, as we know, is problematic and maybe difficult. I thought likely difficult for that age group. But they started because the building where they have the school was a home of Jews who had to escape. And recently, three of the descendants of that family came and knocked on the door and said, "Can we visit this house? Because this belonged to our family." So they have a real context for thinking about history. And they're going to interview those people. I just, any way that we can connect thinking historically or thinking as geographers and historians is a door into or a window into rich subject and content knowledge. So I went on a long time. I thought those were two good examples.
I think they are. And I think that it really connects up with, James, what you were saying about the language around these disciplines. If we teach the children, if we have in our curriculum the words that they need to know to talk about science, to talk like a scientist, or to talk like a historian, these are going to be providing the children with the tools to enact that role and to step into that when they need to do writing. Or you mentioned oracy as well earlier. I'm sure this has got to be a key part of oracy, being able to use language in speech, as Pi Corbett, one of my favorite educators, talks about, is if you can speak it, you can write it. So there's real links here. And also coming back to that, we were saying about there's no doubt that if you are living in the Czech Republic, this is really empowering knowledge and experience of education, which becomes meaningful. And I think we'd all agree, you know, important. When we're talking about things like a curriculum, and we mentioned earlier the idea at the very beginning, we talked about a map, and this the concept of a map was and a journey was brought up. But then also, Cindy, you mentioned that that maybe is too static. It makes me think about how a curriculum can develop and how it can be flexible. When you give a school a curriculum, James, how do you ensure that there is enough flexibility built into it so that it can take change? And it doesn't stay rigid. Is that something you think about?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So what we have never wanted to do is just to kind of develop some curriculum resources that are then downloaded, and then whatever happens, happens. You know, that would be absolutely awful. And it exists so frequently.
The press and play model kind of thing.
Exactly. And that just does not work, you know, and they're depressingly not great quality in the first place. But secondly, there's a fundamental lack of not just training in the sense of pre-recorded training, but actually really getting into detail of the understanding of the principles behind the curriculum. Why is it designed like this? How should it operate? You know, and then coming back to something that we said before as well, there is a huge emphasis on the subject knowledge. And there is a, your planning has been done for you, but it doesn't mean, as I said before, that you're a robot as a teacher, simply standing up, as an automaton. It's bringing the personality to two things. One, to the quality of pedagogy as you enact it in the classroom, but also the individual kind of drama of bringing it to life in many ways, particularly thinking about things like rich storytelling. If someone's talking in a dull monotone, even if they have a great text to read with the children, that the children are ready to access, it's dire. It's absolutely dire. So making sure that, teachers feel empowered in those ways. And then, quite frankly, my worry really is always getting to that fidelity of implementation rather than too much fidelity of implementation right now, because it's never done. Always that degree of understanding, that planning and replanning and thinking, actually, I need to slow down here. I need to really take the time to go into depth here to secure that new knowledge. Actually, I can go quite quickly on this bit. That's fine, and really having a sense of that, it's going to be quite clunky the first time you teach something, but then as you really get the contours of what it is that you're teaching, the richness of it, and feel like you understand the subject knowledge as a teacher, bringing that to life for the children is just such a pleasure.
And how do you, in your work with curriculum, how do you balance that? This is, here's the curriculum and some fidelity and that flexibility when you work with teachers.
Yeah, so it's giving the teachers the materials, and they can't be taught out of sequence, because it's so important that having studied A means that B is then accessible, and then so forth all the way through. But it's working with the teachers, like I say, on that kind of depth of understanding, to be able to, if you get the principles, then you can bring your personality to the implementation. Your rapport with those children in the classroom is fundamental. That's why I say it's not a robot delivering it. It is so fundamental. And you know that, the needs in the room, who to bring in when, make sure the check-in for understanding, and knowing what the children will respond to in terms of, bringing those stories to life, so many rich stories in history, but also storifying images in geography, making it dramatic and all of those different pieces. And that's not something that anyone's ever going to have the time or the space to train a teacher in every single one to say, use this slide like this, use this slide like this. It should, and it has to be based on that, individual interpretation and delivery.
One thing I always find when when thinking about a curriculum design is, and this you mentioned this as well, James, is this bit's going to be harder for children to get, therefore I need to spend longer on it. This bit, as I said, in my experience, children actually get, they get brackets really quickly. Brackets are super easy, but they're going to have to come back and back and back to commas and clauses because that concept takes into account so much more. So I'm going to do 20 minutes on brackets, and I'm going to do maybe 15 lessons over the course of a year on with not lessons but different forms of learning, iterative learning on commas and clauses because it's just such a complex concept to get. I guess that would be for me my big tip in the next question, which is the challenges to be aware when starting out with curriculum design is that sense of time and how long you need to spend on different things. Cindy and James, if there was something you've learned from all your experience of designing curriculums and working with people on this, what are some big things that people could do not to fail? What failures have you experienced? Because I'm sure you have in the early days of putting something together. What would you say people should avoid doing, and what should they do to sort of speed up the process? What are your big tips?
Well, I guess prior to 2019 and the change in the Ofsted framework in particular, there in primary especially, there has been a very long tail of taking thematic approaches, which just doesn't fit with what we know about, learning bodies of knowledge. I heard, examples like this week's theme is red. So whatever subject it is, we're talking about red. I mean, it's bonkers when you think about it. But that has taken a long time, to really kind of be overhauled and for people to really buy into. No, the subject comes first. Cross-curricular links are great, but they can't be forced and distort, what is happening within each subject. I think on the flip side, knowledge rich can really go wrong. When it's when it is the kind of grad grindy and rote learning of facts. Yes, kids love learning facts, but they have to be able to make meaning. And that's what knowledge is all about. Understanding significance and taking that from the material and being able to get right not just the substance of what we want them to have encountered as knowledge, but also obviously the disciplinary knowledge as well. So how does a historian use sources to make truth claims, and why is that different to how a geographer does it? What evidence do they use? What does a mathematician use in terms of specific logic? What does a scientist use in terms of using the empirical method? These are different ways of, the disciplinary knowledge is so vital alongside the substance that you want them to learn. But I think fundamentally, that in a way, the kind of the test I think is quite a good one that Ofsted alighted on, which is, four things really. Scope, is it broad enough that it covers the right things, particularly the national curriculum, but goes beyond? Coherence, does it all make sense and fit together? Again, starting with those vertical lines of subjects, but making cross-curricular links. Rigor, is it based on the latest scholarship? Is it based on any genuine scholarship at all, quite frankly? And is it well sequenced? Does each subject unfold and build up, making those increasing levels of meaning, to that kind of up to that partial, as I say, conclusion in year six?
So, yes, I to everything that you said in terms of curriculum design, but I think for me, the biggest challenge in curriculum design is keeping in mind the people who are in the classroom and who are actually going to be using the curriculum, and what does it mean to them, and what do they need to understand, and how do we support that? My experience with curriculum design and implementation when I was at a university in the States was that when you come in with a carefully designed curriculum with all of the elements that James just described and make perfect sense in my world as well, you can't just come in and say, here it is. And every time as curriculum designers or reform projects, we come in and we try to do that, I think it fails. Because we're not the ones in the classroom. We're not the ones working with the kids. And I think that a part of the challenge in curriculum design is including educators like David, like my two daughters who are teachers, in that process so that it makes sense to them and it can be meaningful. Otherwise, we all know teachers walk in their classroom and close the door and they do what they believe in. And so, where do we start with them so that their beliefs match and are informed by the curriculum?
Thank you. Thank you both. That's given me a lot to think about, and I'm sure it's giving listeners a lot to think about as well. And also what's crucial about sort of something like a podcast where you're trying to cover a huge area in just sort of 40 or 45 minutes is it's bringing up more questions than I think it has answers. I could keep asking questions for a long time, but I'm going to bring it to an end with just one final question, which I like to ask to every guest who comes on the podcast, which is, what are you most excited about in education right now? What it doesn't have to be to do with curriculum, could be to do with any area. It could be a book or a podcast or just something that you are really passionate about in education.
I'm actually very passionate about some things that have come out of this conversation today. And that's how do we balance a focus on thinking and nurturing and growing students' curiosity with the knowledge, rich knowledge that James has been talking about. I think that's the biggest challenge that we face. And I'm still, after all my years as an educator, passionate about trying to understand that better.
Brilliant. Thank you. I wholeheartedly agree on that. That's an area we could spend a lifetime, many lifetimes on. James, what about you?
Yeah, so I think a lot of what we've been talking about really is at the heart of what excites me. And I think, being frank, I'm not sure teachers have had the level of training for some time that maybe would have in the past or even in other countries. And yet, what makes me really excited and positive is that I think we've got a richer understanding of cognitive science, of pedagogy, of curriculum than there's ever been in the past by just a million miles. And that's so exciting to be able to, it's not finalized as a body of knowledge. It's not like we found the answer and that's it. It's still so much to be explored. However, having that and being able to really embed that in the profession rather than the whims of whichever government is in power, pushing on a more progressive level or a more traditional level or whatever, that is the kind of dinner room party politics, I think having a real anchor in the profession that's based on, rooted in evidence and really high quality practice, I think that's just so exciting.
It really is. And also feeling ourselves be part of a body of professionals within the UK, but also internationally as well, and linked in many different ways, as I know we all are, with people working in different areas. It feels like a really exciting time to be in education, for sure. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. You've been listening to The Restless Education. We've been considering what makes an excellent primary curriculum. In our next podcast, we will be looking at what makes an excellent secondary curriculum with a different guest and actually a different host, because I won't be on that. But in the meantime, thank you so much, Cindy and James, for joining us.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David. Thank you.
And do listen in, do send us any questions to restlesseducation@gmail.com. Follow us on LinkedIn and keep listening.